welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Valdana Hyrick, a cross-asset reporter at Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, everyone is freaking out about interest rates again. The 10-year Treasury yield is up 20-some basis points since the Federal Reserve's September 22nd meeting. That's when the central bank signaled that tapering of its asset purchases will likely commence sometime this year. At the same time, well, remember that soap opera surrounding the debt ceiling? It's been renewed for another season. So has the drama about a potential hard landing in China's economy. So what's it all mean for your investments? We'll get into it with the chief investment strategist at a major investment firm. But first, we have a very special announcement from Charlie Pellett himself.
Well, every good mystery must come to an end, so we'll keep you in suspense no longer. What Goes Up is pleased to announce that Valdana Hyrick will be the new co-host of the show permanently, or at least until Regan drives her nuts.
I like how Charlie could not resist getting a dig in on me on that introduction there, Valdana. But
which I really appreciate. By the way, this is news to me.
Oh, well, yeah. Surprise.
Oh, thanks.
We know how much you love the attention and the spotlight to be on you. So I don't at all. You'll get used to it.
But I love everything Charlie does. So I appreciate that.
That's one of the members here that you love. Like, okay.
Yeah.
That's fair enough.
Yeah.
But yeah, very proud to have you, Valdana. I mean, I obviously enjoyed the mystery co-host gimmick for as long as it lasted, but longtime listeners will know Valdana has been a major behind the scenes contributor to the show since its beginning. That Valdana energy is unrivaled, and she's importantly, she's on the phone every day with smart people who may or may not realize that they're actually auditioning for a guest spot on the
podcast.
Right. So I don't know if you tell them that.
I never do. And I think that might have been the case with this week's guest. We can ask him. I want to introduce this week's guest. It's Brian Nick. He's the chief investment strategist at Nuveen. And he also used to work at the New York Fed. So I think he's the perfect guest for the podcast this week. Thank you for joining us, Brian.
Thank you very much for having me. And I would say every time I talk to a reporter, I secretly hope that I'm auditioning for a podcast. So this is fantastic.
It's every strategist's dream, right?
It is.
It finally paid off.
Well, Brian, you know, as Valdana said, you started early in your career working at the markets desk at the Fed itself. So I want to hope you can kind of put that Fed hat on again before we actually get into your views on the market. And just talk to us a little bit about what you're expecting for the tapering process. You know, how aggressive will the Fed be? How soon are you expecting sort of the normalization of interest rates to follow after tapering? And you know, how do you think is the market prepared for what's coming? Or is it overpricing, underpricing any of the risks here?
Yeah. So I think from the Fed's perspective, they have this sort of institutional memory of the last crisis when they did wait a very long time after the financial crisis, 3 or 4 years before they even were talking about tapering their bond purchases. And they were off and on with QE1, QE2, QE3, but it took until 2013 and 2014 for them to actually get, you know, busy with the task of rolling down those bond purchases. And in retrospect, they probably think they did that too quickly. Jay Powell himself has said the economy is actually in better shape today than it was in 2013 when they first announced that taper and the market had a big tantrum about it and interest rates doubled in a pretty short period of time. So the Fed is taking lessons of the last recovery and their part in, you know, getting to the period of higher interest rates and fewer bond purchases. And it probably thinks it went too quickly, tightened too quickly, even by what at the time seemed like very, very slow standards. And so this Fed has become much more dovish in its reaction function to hotter economic data, whether it's growth or higher inflation, much more tolerant of inflation. I'd say almost dismissive. When you hear a Fed chair get up in front of everybody and say, well, the difference between 2.4% and 2%, you know, the average household's not going to feel that. You know, we're not in Paul Volcker territory anymore, right, when we have a Fed chair saying that. And obviously, inflation has been much higher than 2.4% this year. And the Fed has been extremely tolerant, continuing to do the asset purchases, continuing to really shoo off any notion that they're going to be raising interest rates anytime soon. I think they got to a point where even the doves on the committee were comfortable that liquidity was ample. This emergency stimulus, you know, bond buying program was probably no longer doing a whole lot of good. Probably wasn't doing harm, but wasn't going to be helping anymore. And so I think they were very explicit, in fact, more explicit than I expected them to be at the September meeting, that they would be heading into November with the expectation they'd be announcing a taper, probably start that in December, wind it down maybe $15 billion a month until they're done at the end of July. And I think that's probably the timeline that we're looking for. Probably a bit more aggressive than maybe a few months ago what we would have expected. But I think with the COVID cases sort of peaking and coming down, some of the economic data has actually turned a bit better. And inflation hasn't gone away as an issue for the Fed to have to consider. This is probably kind of the median outcome for markets. In terms of interest rate hikes, I do think this is where maybe the market is being a little bit too aggressive, pricing in Fed hikes. Yes, the Fed dots are telling us that about half the members think that they should be raising rates next year at least once. That means also half the members don't think they should be raising rates next year or won't have to raise rates next year. And I think there will be more doves on the committee a year from now than there are now, because Biden's going to pick two or three new Fed governors that'll probably be more inclined not to raise rates. And so I wouldn't look for them to lift off until the first part of 2023, with the caveat being that if inflation continues to come in a lot hotter than expected, that may be pulled forward into the second half of next year.
So, Brian, obviously we saw a spike in Treasury yields right after the Fed meeting, or maybe not right after. I think in a story I wrote, we said something like 18 hours afterwards. So is that what's behind the sell-off in the bond market? Is it what we, you know, was it sparked by what we heard from the Fed, or is it more so the outlook for growth? Is it both? Can you walk us through your thinking there?
Sure. I think it follows the pattern of a taper tantrum, except in a much more mild case than we saw in 2013. You have real interest rates rising. You don't really have inflation expectations doing much. So the market's not screaming that the Fed's making a huge mistake by tapering. If you think all the way back to June, that meeting when the dots were interpreted as being more hawkish and the Fed maybe kind of mishandled its communication, spooked the markets a little bit into thinking it was going to be a bit too hawkish, you actually saw long-term interest rates fall, which is a sign that the market, at least the bond market, thinks the Fed's making a mistake and going too quickly. With the September meeting, I think it was handled a bit better, the communication, the separation of the bond buying from the interest rate liftoff. Again, the dismissive attack toward inflation, I think, all probably also got markets' attention. So when you have interest rates rising, you have the yield curve steepening, I think it's a sign that the markets are optimistic about growth. And I think you have to consider the context. Yes, the Fed was probably sort of the proximate cause for the increase in rates, but we also have now a clear decline in U.S. and global COVID cases. So it seems like the Delta variant is in decline in many more places than it's on the rise at this point. And the economic data sort of sneakily has gotten a little bit better, or at least is less prone to disappointment than it was over the summer. We got a really good retail sales number. Some of the housing numbers, home construction was better than expected. And so I think that the overall tone has become a bit more optimistic, maybe reversing some of the pessimism we saw in July and August, which is when rates were declining for reasons that to us at the time were pretty mysterious. So a bit of a reversal of what we saw then. Not quite risk on, because we've seen the equity markets and how they've behaved, but I think an overall more optimistic tone in the bond market that sees the Fed as pretty much getting things right and not too many other things interfering with the general story, which is slower economic growth from a very, very high rate and peak in the second quarter, and at least a number of quarters of above trend growth ahead. So, you know, I think still relatively smooth sailing for the U.S. economy.
Brian, so obviously equity valuations are super high, at least compared with history. Credit spreads are razor thin. And you set up some thoughts here to Valdana and I, sort of your general thoughts about the market. And one point you made, I think, is really interesting. You said that the economy is early to mid-cycle, but markets are late cycle, you know, presumably looking at valuation metrics like that. And I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. I agree. I completely agree. But I'm wondering how you think that resolves itself. I mean, to me, there's kind of two maybe main possibilities. You know, obviously the markets can sort of, you know, come down and drag the economy down with them into the late cycle or, you know, end of the cycle for the economy. Or, you know, I always think maybe you get that correction on the x-axis of the chart rather than the y-axis. You know, in other words, just a market that goes nowhere for a while until earnings catch up, that sort of thing, rather than a sharp drop in price that brings things back to sort of a mean reversion in valuations. But how are you thinking about how that will resolve itself, this discrepancy between where the economy is, what part of the cycle, and where the markets seem to be in the cycle?
Yeah, so just quickly, I think to put some meat on the bones of the argument, if you look at the economy, the unemployment rate's not high, but it's higher than it was pre-pandemic. We have a lot of people who haven't even entered or re-entered the labor force yet. So I think there's still many millions of more people who will be getting jobs in the next, call it 6 to 18 months. And so that it's a sign that if you're creating jobs at that clip, it's still early cycle. Savings rates are very high, which is not abnormal after a recession when people have built up savings, although the reason that they're high is much different because it's massive fiscal stimulus and people, you know, essentially confined to their homes for many, many months. And then things like inventories, companies are scrambling to restock inventories. They let them wind all the way down. That's something that happens early in an economic cycle as well. Whereas the markets are behaving almost as if the pandemic never happened. Equity valuations, to your point, are higher than they were pre-pandemic. They're a little bit off their peaks from earlier in the year. They have been coming down because the market's been doing less well than earnings growth has been doing. But credit spreads are certainly extremely resilient and much better, have exhibited, you know, late cycle signs in a way that that they weren't even doing before the pandemic. So how does this resolve itself? I think your point about maybe the market's not giving you a whole lot as a diversified investor for some period of time, I think is probably the way we see this resolving as the economy continues to decelerate gently. I think we get, you know, slightly less good market returns, and we're seeing, you know, the third quarter has resolved in a way that the, you know, net S&P 500 really hasn't gone much of anywhere. Interest rates are incrementally higher than they were to start the quarter. But really, it's a 360 degree turn throughout the quarter. So a little bit of treading water already this early in the cycle. And I think investors can expect some more of that. Doesn't mean there's not opportunities in places. Credit outperformed in the third quarter. But it's going to be, I think, more frustrating, certainly for anybody who's gotten used to the last 18 months or go back 10 years of returns. For somebody in a 60-40, 50-50 portfolio to generate those types of returns when markets have already moved so fast, so forward in terms of, you know, pricing in a very good and mature economic cycle when we haven't really arrived at that point yet, I think from a fundamental standpoint. The other way it could resolve is that we're just wrong about the economic cycle being early and the labor market is actually much tighter than we think and those workers aren't coming back. And that means we do get your classic kind of overheating, the Fed has become too dovish and has gotten behind the eight ball. And that's where you get the kind of the rapid end of the cycle. We talk about that as an investment committee. We talk about that at Nuveen quite frequently as a big risk, but we don't think that's something we should be acutely worried about unless there's more evidence in some of these jobs reports coming out soon that there really aren't that many more people on the sidelines looking to get back to work.
So just to tie a few of these things together, everything that's going on with the bond market and then, you know, what we've seen from the stock market so far this year. I know one of the things that we were thinking about is just what the background looks like, the economic background looks like right now with yields spiking versus what the setup looked like back in the spring when we were seeing, you know, similar things happening in the bond market. And I think some people would argue that the economic background just looking forward, it doesn't look as strong as when everybody was looking forward to the reopening. Then at the same time, you did, as you just said, we have seen stocks run up quite a lot since then. So does that mean like through the end of the year, just the bullish setup for the market is a little bit less constructive, or how are you thinking about it?
Yeah, so this economic period that we've been in, starting with the first quarter, most people who are investors today have never experienced something like this before, where we have 6 or 7% GDP growth for a period of 6 months, and then we're decelerating from that. But the absolute level of growth in the third quarter is still going to make it one of the best quarters that we've seen in several decades, right? Even if it's 3.5 or 4.5, I mean, that's well above normal, certainly post-financial crisis and even before that. So we're still running the economy hot here, and we should still be seeing, you know, solid contributions from consumers, albeit not as good as the first half of the year when they were getting stimulus checks and other kinds of transfer payments that was enabling consumption to be artificially high. We got that second quarter revision for GDP, where now consumer spending annualized at like 12% in the second quarter. That's just not going to happen in the third. What didn't happen in the third quarter is not going to happen in the fourth quarter. But it's still going to be solid. People are still drawing down on considerable savings. We know that businesses need to restock inventories. We know they're making investments to try to make those workers more productive. That, by the way, is one of the things that can help forestall more inflation, is if we just get more productivity out of the existing workforce, we can pay those people more without having to charge higher prices to the end customers. So there's a lot of good things happening in the economy. Global manufacturing output is an all-time high. Trade flows are close to their all-time highs. But we don't have this huge demand shock every single quarter the way we did in Q1 and Q2, because the fiscal stimulus is going to very quickly go from being a net plus to, once it sort of expires and becomes a drag, a net minus. And that's going to mean that, yeah, the growth rate's going to come down. It's going to come down to 4-ish, 3-ish, 2-ish. And probably by the end of next year, we'll kind of get a sense of where the new normal is. Maybe it's, you know, 1.5% to 2.5% growth, something like what we were used to pre-pandemic. But we know from experience that equities can do fine in that scenario. Credit can certainly do fine in that scenario. And some of the, I think, rotations that we've seen into more those more familiar outperformers like technology and broadly defined a lot of, you know, higher growth companies, you know, that I think has been of a piece with a recognition that growth is decelerating. While we might get pockets of cyclical outperformance here and there, like the ones we've been in for the last few weeks, I think for the most part, we're settling back down into a more familiar pattern for growth, albeit after several quite good quarters for the U.S. economy, which would still, you know, mean we're creating jobs, we're seeing wages move up, and yes, inflation's still probably running above where the Fed would ideally like it to be.
So, Brian, I think regular listeners of this show listen up for two main things when they listen to this show. One is the craziest things we saw in the market. That's your real test. We'll get to that later. That's your real doctorate thesis there that we'll get to. But the other question they look out for is, well, just tell me what to buy right now for a guy like you. You know, I know, Nuveen, you've got a big AUM. What is it? 1.2 trillion or something like that.
That's right. 1.2.
Bigger than Bitcoin, we'll say.
depends on the day.
Yeah, it depends on the day. But, you know, so obviously you got your eye on across all asset classes, across all, you know, markets around the world. What is sticking out, you know, to you now as sort of worth investing in right now, to simplify it to sort of the most basic question?
Yeah, so we do have this sort of late market cycle thesis, which means that a lot of things that would normally at this stage look inexpensive, look to us fully valued or maybe even a bit expensive. The question is, looking outside of those areas, which I think make up the bread and butter traditional diversified portfolios that people invest in, that's going to be the key. And it's really up to the individual. Are you diversifying fully into things like illiquid alternatives, private credit, farmland, timber? Those are all things that we're, you know, keen on getting investors into if we can. But I think even for investors who don't have that liquidity tolerance or that ability to allocate to alternatives, it's things like emerging market credit, which is an asset class that still looks early cycle compared to the U.S. markets. There's always a bit of a penalty just for being emerging markets. But EM credit is one of the nice things about it. It's a little bit less China exposure than if you go with the EM equity side. So less sort of idiosyncratic ad hoc China regulatory risk, which is a big theme in the third quarter. And then an environment that we know is going to be a reach for yield, increasing risk tolerance for fixed income investors as the global economy continues to do fine. People are going to be looking for areas where they can earn extra income, and that's going to be one of them. And then things like bank loans, so floating rate loans, also for the U.S., also a big asset class sort of tactical preference for us as well, in an environment of rising interest rates, and it's underperformed high yield just a little bit. So if you're looking at that loan versus credit trade, the loans look a little bit more attractive to us too. And that, you know, we're very focused on income. Almost every asset class we do has some sort of income bent to it. And so that's one area that we're certainly looking for. And then something else that we talk about at every investment committee meeting and sort of in our DNA is ESG investing. Specifically, one thing we talked about at this last meeting, and we're going to be writing about in the fourth quarter outlook, is paying more attention to the S, the social in ESG. And just as an example, looking and trying to find ways to measure employee satisfaction with their company. So you can look at how much companies pay their employees as a sort of a, should I invest in this company or not? It tends to be a pretty bad predictor for how the stock's going to do. But if you wrap up employee compensation into things like training, benefits, opportunities, lifestyle, work-life balance, and can find ways to measure those things, that's where the positive alpha comes in. So if you have that ESG component to your security selection, that's something that can help at the margins too in an environment where we know it's very hard to be a reliable stock picker.
Free snacks, I think. If you can correlate free snacks from a company to their returns, I think we'll find some.
You know, we had just gotten the free snacks just before the pandemic, so they may still be sitting in the office somewhere.
You have to replenish them. Just rewind a little bit, and you did mention China. You sounded a little China-averse there for a minute. And, you know, I wonder, you look at some of the dislocations that have happened in the Chinese market in recent months, and it's, I mean, it's got to be tempting to go bargain hunting across, whether it be equities or credits, you know, even sovereign yields always in China looking a little bit better than most of the rest of the world. But you know, what's your thinking on China right now? A lot of people saying it's simply uninvestable right now with this regulatory crackdown going on. I mean, do you take it that far, or is there a middle ground where you try to, you know, take advantage of some of this dislocation, but maybe not expose yourself too much to it?
Yeah, I think you said it with the middle ground. We actually had three different emerging market speakers at our investment committee meeting, and from around Nuveen. You guess what happened when we get three people? One of them is a bit more bullish, one of them is bearish, and one of them sort of in between. And I think, you know, we're not going to say that China's uninvestable, because it's in an economy that big, that's growing that fast, that has, you know, a lot of kind of positive stories, whether it's technology, whether it's manufacturing, you know, just taking it off the table is very hard to do, even if you wanted to, because it's such a huge part of these benchmark indexes that any kind of China-specific risk is going to destroy your ability to make, you know, to add value elsewhere in the portfolio. And you don't want your entire performance to be hostage to what's going on with China. So I think the idea is we want to be about market weight China. And we're not, you know, bottom fishing in areas that are at high risk for governmental capture, but we want to be much more selective. And I know that's, you know, that's never like the most satisfying answer, that we want to be more selective and sharpen our pencils and find the right opportunities. But it really is trying to identify areas where the government may have an interest in becoming more active, AKA reducing shareholder value, reducing profit margins because they're serving some kind of larger economic or political purpose, and looking more to areas that China is probably going to allow a bit of more of a laissez-faire attitude because they're talking about companies that are trying to compete with the US and other areas of the world on a global stage. And that, I think a lot of that is going to be in tech. Some of that will be in manufacturing as well. But it has become undoubtedly much, much, much harder, because you could have been underweight China in the third quarter, and if you just had the wrong names in the portfolio, you still could have underperformed because of the acute underperformance of whether it was gaming, whether it was that for-profit education sector, or whether it was areas of tech that were, you know, again, surprised with sort of that, you know, that ad hoc regulatory capture.
Yeah, it does kind of overlap with the ESG notion to some degree. I mean, trying to figure out, you know, ESG through the lens of Xi Jinping, you know, a lot of this stuff, there's overlap there, I guess.
There is. And when you talk about ESG in the United States, it's usually a data issue. You think you have a thesis on what I can do to allocate towards certain type of companies, or maybe away from certain types of companies, depending on the issue. But it's all about getting the right data. With China, there's not much of a hope of getting a lot of transparent data at the very, very micro levels. We're talking like operating statements and earnings reports. We're talking more things like I said, employee satisfaction, you know, net carbon emissions, that kind of thing. Much, much harder to get when it comes to China, but it's still the same, I think, overall tone, is that you want to avoid investing in places where there could be reputational risk, country risk, single company issues that end up, again, if you're overallocated to these certain areas, end up torpedoing your performance.
Brian, just to close out our grilling of you, I want to ask you to look ahead to the next earnings season, which is supposed to kick off in just a couple days. I think it's October 13th that we start to see some of the banks releasing earnings. So can you just tell us, like, what will you be looking for? Because I know my inbox is always flooded whenever we hear these warnings from companies like Sherwin-Williams, that we've heard over the last couple of days. So what will you be looking for? And is there anything that would be really concerning to hear from company management?
Yeah, so it's a continuation of the second quarter where we were really looking for statements or evidence that there was a declining profit margin because of a combination of higher input costs, raw materials for some firms, and higher labor costs because there was a shortage of available workers or workers able to work at the wage that was being offered. And we didn't actually see that much of that, even at the places that we know the sort of the price pressures or the labor costs are a bit of a stress. For example, restaurants, fast food industry would be an area where you would expect to see some stress. We didn't see that as much in the second quarter. I think part of that's just demand was so strong that revenue growth was able to kind of overwhelm rising costs. But we know that revenue growth is going to be slowing down, like the economy, which peaked in the second quarter. Earnings growth almost certainly peaked in the second quarter as well, just because of base effects. So we're going to be seeing, fully expect to see, a decline in the year-on-year rate of earnings growth, and probably more anecdotal evidence that inflation, especially raw materials, maybe supply chain disruptions, and maybe a combination of all those things and labor costs is eating into profit margins. I don't think that's necessarily a flashing red light for investors. I think it's perfectly natural that you'd see profit margins peak in a very, very hot quarter for growth and then kind of decline from there. But we don't want to see, abrupt declines in profit margins accompanied by very kind of pessimistic outlooks for profitability because all of these issues are kind of coming to a head. That would be my concern. And one of the things that, even if the bond market doesn't step in and tell the Fed that it's time to raise interest rates, profitability of U.S. corporations might be doing that. I don't think that's going to be a huge issue in the third quarter, but I think it's the thing I'm most intently looking at for sort of a common theme across different industries.
Well, you know what I'm most intently looking at, Vildana?
Yeah, I know.
Care to hazard a guess? You know, as co-host, you're contractually obligated to laugh at my jokes now. You realize that, right?
Oh, sorry. It's just so hard because I can't sometimes... They don't even sound like jokes.
That's what makes them funny. Yeah, you really got to be paying attention there. Anyway.
Oh, my gosh.
Enough with that. It's time for the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
I'm going to say I got a really good one. I hate to declare myself the winner already, but we'll go through the motions with you two, but mine's pretty good. So I'm going to wait till last. Vildana, let's start with you. What's the craziest thing you saw in markets this week?
So, Mike, I want to give a shout out to our producer, Topher Forges, who flagged this story to me and you, actually. So you might already be familiar with it. But it's a CNN story, and the headline is, "This hamster's cryptocurrency portfolio is beating the market." And it's amazing. It's like, honestly, the craziest thing I've seen in a really long time. It's this German hamster, and he's beating investors at their own game, apparently. So he has this little spinning wheel, and he sort of runs around, and then like wherever he ends up, if it's like a buy or a sell, it triggers these purchases, I think. And so he's been doing really, really well, and his portfolio has Ether and Bitcoin, and I mean, you can't. I think I win with this one. You can't get better than that.
When it comes to cryptocurrencies, that strategy makes as much sense as just about every other one I've heard. So I'll take the Hampson. Bert McHill had the monkey throwing darts at a dartboard. So why not a hamster? That should be the benchmark. The hamster, the crypto benchmark. That's a pretty good one. That's a pretty good one.
We should make an index of like what the hamster is tracking, and then just see.
Yeah, you get on. You should get on that.
How well it does. We need a ticker.
Ham. H-A-M.
Hamst.
Hamst. All right, that one's pretty good. I'll give you props for that one. How about you, Brian? Have you seen anything crazy this week in markets?
Well, I was going to suggest that we look at the octopus that predicted the World Cup and see if he or she can come up with a better crypto strategy. So I'm going to cheat a little bit and stretch the definition of markets to include prediction markets for what's going on in Washington, D.C. Now, these are not the U.S. Treasury market, not the deepest, most liquid markets in the world. But when you are kind of on Twitter religiously like I am, kind of following the minute to minute what's going on with the reconciliation bill, there's this really cool predicted market on unpredicted that is basically saying how big is the reconciliation bill going to be. And as this crazy week kind of wore on, the 1.5 trillion and under category got a much, much stronger bid as we kind of wore on. I had been kind of thinking it was the 2 trillion number was sort of the over under. We're going to get close to there. But, you know, now that it seems like there's even less agreement or consensus on these spending bills, that the potential is it falls apart completely or it just becomes a much, much smaller number. Now, that's the most fun, weird thing I saw in markets this week. The extra bit of weirdness that I'd add to it is the financial markets seem completely uninterested in this. To the best of my ability, I can't discern any movement in the 10-year treasury, the S&P 500, market leadership, based on what's going on with this bill, because I don't think there's a great understanding of what's in it other than a sort of a lot of kind of transfer payments that could help the economy or could hurt the economy, depending on if you're paying more taxes or receiving more in benefits. But it's being doled out over, you know, 5 or 8 or 10 years, depending on how they get it done. It just is dwarfed by all the stimulus we've done that's hit bottom lines immediately in the last 18 months. And it almost seems like we kind of have this, that we've gotten used to these huge fiscal influxes into the economy that when you tell it's going to be, oh, it's $2 trillion over 10 years, we kind of shrug at that number, even though it's still a massive amount of money. But it doesn't seem like it's having much of an impact on markets for the time being.
That's a good one. I love the predictions market. We'll allow that anytime. How about the debt ceiling? Is the debt ceiling keeping you up at night, or is this the typical game of chicken that's going to end at the 11th hour, like we've seen in the past?
So this is my second favorite predicted contract, which is, will the debt ceiling be raised by October 15th? And then Janet Yellen comes out this week and says the drop dead date is the 18th. So I'm a big no on the 15th, because why would they do it 3 days early if they right? If you got an extra 3 days, you know Congress is going to use it. There's going to be a lot of brinksmanship. My sense is that Democrats are going to use a reconciliation process, which is a big pain in the neck for them, and get it in there and get it through and passed by the 18th. And the reason they're saying they're not going to do that, they want to wait until the last minute, because they want Republicans to basically have to cave on letting them do it quickly. Because the Republicans are not going to vote to raise the debt ceiling, but they're not going to throw obstacles in the way of the Democrats for spite as they're trying to kind of scramble to get this done at the 11th hour. So I would say if you're up on October 17th at 11:59 Eastern and in 59 seconds, that's probably about when I'd expect the debt ceiling to be raised.
That sounds about right. I'll have to look up and see if there's a $1 trillion coin market on predicted. That's the other option.
Not yet, but it's still early days.
All right, those are good. You guys, stiff competition this week, but now I can give you the winning entry in the craziest thing. I'm just kidding. We'll call it a three-way tie, but mine's pretty good. And this is courtesy of our colleague Nick Baker, who turned me onto this market. I can't believe I've never heard about it before. It's called the Royalties Exchange. Have you ever heard of this, Phil Donna? It's not like royal family members. You know, you can't trade, Prince Henry for, I don't know, but it's royalties
like
from music
royalties.
And movies, I guess, too. So up for auction this week were the royalties from the jingle, The Best Part of Waking Up. You remember the Folgers jingle?
Oh,
you know,
sure.
Yeah. Classic jingle. So, Folgers still uses it from time to time. So you're kind of at the mercy of when they decide to use it or not. I guess maybe, I don't know, Kanye West could cover it, too. Who knows? And you get royalties that way. But I think that the mainstream of royalties is from the commercials when Folgers uses it. So we're going to play prices right here. Let's break out your dividend discount model, Brian, or whatever you call it in this case. So the royalties, last 12-month royalties for this jingle were $11,747, right? Now, here's the deal with this. If you buy this, you get the royalties for the lifetime of the author, who actually had to go and look up. Her name's Leslie Pearl. She's 69, still alive. So you get it for the duration of her lifetime plus 70 years. So, you know, you got at least 70 years there. She could live to 100, and, you know, then you got 100 years out of it. So $11,700 in royalties in the trailing 12 months. What would you bid for that? Based on that information, and I've got the latest bid. The auction's like got 2 hours left in it, so we're pretty close to the final bid. Let's start with you, Voldana. What's your bid for the royalties for the Folgers jingle?
I saw this story, so I might be cheating if I give you an answer.
You're allowed to cheat. It's fine.
Oh, okay. I think Well, Brian, you go first. So he doesn't get
I
any
I was going to run down and ask my wife, who's an actuary, how long this lady's going to live. That would give me an inside track on the answer.
I know. We need more information on her lifestyle habits, I think, too.
Okay, so it's 100 years, $11,000 a year with some kind of very low interest rate, because I'm assuming interest rates are going down forever.
Yeah, applied, your discount rate, yep.
Applied to it. So, let's see, $975,000.
It's a pretty good guess. I would guess, I'm not going to tell you what I would guess. Vildana, what's your guess?
I was going to say $27,000.
Oh, wow. That's a big bid-ask spread right there.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm misremembering the story.
$83,350, which to your point, Brian, I think is a bargain. I mean, you.
Yeah, right.
You do the math, you're talking about like a 14% yield off of this thing. I mean, yes. granted, you don't get your return of capital at the end of the 100 years, no, but that income stream, I would think would be worth a lot more than 83 grand. I don't know.
I think I'm discounting it much too low an interest rate, but I think I'm probably right to do so.
I agree. But yeah, pretty good bargain on the Folgers jingle. If it, 2 hours left, if either of you wants to get in on that, Vildana, you could, I wonder if they'll just let me transfer half my 401k into that and just, bid it up. I don't know.
You could try. Yeah. Good luck.
I don't know if royalties are a valid 401k.
Only if you do it only if you really like Folgers coffee. If you don't, just.
I don't know why Folgers just doesn't buy it for 84 grand. If they're spending 12 grand a year on the royalties, I don't know why they don't buy it, but
it'll pay off in a couple of years.
I'm going to go talk to the people at Folgers and we'll figure that out. But with that said, I think that's all the time we have. Brian, Nick, really enjoyed the conversation. Hopefully we can get you back again sometime. You passed Vildana's audition.
You can get me back anytime. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you, Brian.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Vildana Heirich is at Vildana Heirich. This week's guest, Brian Nick, is at Brian Nick Nuveen. And you can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Voorhees. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.